Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the former Biscayne Park Police Chief, Raimundo Atassiano, will be spending the next 3 years of his life in prison. He's charged in the false framing of three black men for crimes they didn't commit. Atassiano was sentenced last Tuesday in U.S. District Court. He blamed the pressure he received from the community to tout a 100% burglary clearance record. Now, over the past several months, Miami Herald reporters Jay Weaver, David Ovalle, and Chuck Rabin have been reporting on the investigation into the police chief and his officers' actions. David Ovalle joins us now from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald. David, always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So how did this investigation into the Biscayne Park Police Department even begin? I mean, when did suspicion surrounding these actions even pop up?
Well, it goes back to about 2014 when some of the officers themselves began sending letters to the city manager, to the village manager, asking for, you know, basically complaining about what was going on and asking for an investigation. And ultimately, an outside investigator was hired by the village, and they ended up doing an investigation and ended up getting kicked over to the state attorney's office down the road. And then the public corruption unit there started working with the federal authorities, or the federal U.S. attorney's office. And then it just spiraled in there, and it culminated last week with Atassiano being sentenced to 3 years in prison for violating the civil rights of various individuals.
And Chief Atassiano argued that he argued to the judge that he was getting pressure to have this perfect, clear arrest record. I mean, who's the pressure coming from?
Well, you got to understand, Biscayne Village is a very small little slice of suburbia, kind of wedged between North Miami and Miami Shores. They don't have any businesses. It is a completely residential area. So this is like, you know, burglaries is a huge deal for this little town. And pretty extraordinarily, in the sentencing, his lawyer basically said, look, he should have never been chief. He was basically a road patrol guy who was in over his head. Atassiano himself said, look, I wasn't prepared for this job when I took it. And so he felt the pressure from village leaders to make sure that this was a perfect clearance rate on burglaries. Now, when you go back and you talk to the people who were there at the time, they say there was never any undue pressure, that there was never any explicit or even implicit pressure to get these clearances under control. But, you know, this was somebody that wasn't, high in stature before he became chief. So, you know, he wanted to impress the city, and he wanted to impress the residents of the town.
What conversations were there with the former police officers about the guidance that they received from Atassiano?
Well, they pretty much said it was understood that, you know, it was he basically instructed them to just find people who had shady criminal histories or who had enough criminal histories that it wouldn't be surprising for them to get arrested for these car break-ins and these home break-ins. At least one officer said the instructions were to find African-American men. The others did not say that, but it was pretty clear it was basically find anyone that we can, that has a criminal record that would allow us to be able to pin these burglaries on them where it wouldn't be such a stretch. Atassiano, at his sentencing, his lawyer pretty much was still sort of saying, look, these guys weren't saints. There was probable cause. So he kind of was playing it both ways, even at his sentencing. But in the end, these guys didn't commit any of these burglaries. Whether they had criminal past for other things is a separate issue. But they were innocent of these burglaries.
And were you able to speak with any of those men?
No, you know, the youngest one, who was a guy who identified by the initials of TD, he has so far not spoken publicly, even though he's filed a lawsuit against Biscayne Park. And one of the men is got deported to Haiti. And so we've been trying to get an interview with him. So far, I haven't had any luck. But certainly they were victimized. They were victims. And the judge, I believe, took that into account when it came to sentencing.
And is the community, the state, is anybody required to pay the victims for the time that they had to spend imprisoned?
Well, only one of them ended up spending any time in prison. Of course, the other ones were spent some days in jail before the state attorney's office ended up just kicking out the cases because they realized there was problems with filing and going forward on the charges. But for the man who ended up spending 5 years in prison, he's now in Haiti and he's filed a lawsuit. So, you know, I imagine that down the road there'll be, you know, talks about a settlement or a possible trial. But even though he's in Haiti, he has retained counsel here. And so that remains to be seen.
I'm talking with Miami Herald reporter David Ovalle. Last week, the Biscayne Park police chief was sentenced to 3 years in prison for instructing his officers to frame and arrest black men for crimes they did not commit. And he's joining us now from the studios in Doral. So, David, U.S. District Judge Michael K. Moore ended up giving the police chief a 3-year sentence. Do we know how he came to that decision? And I mean, obviously, you've seen it on social media. Some people are angry. They think that's not enough.
Well, you know, he definitely got the most prison time of the officers that were involved, and naturally so, because he was the top cop at the time. He actually ended up getting a few more months than what the prosecutors were asking for at the bottom of the sentencing guidelines. But, you know, the judge did not articulate exactly, you know, his feelings. I mean, he didn't, you know, read him the Riot Act or anything like that, like you might expect. So why that particular number? But, you know, definitely was more than the others got. You know, it's federal court, and he took the plea. He did admit to doing this. So I'm sure that factored into some of it, the remorse, or at least the act of, you know, actually admitting it.
Yeah, and what about those other officers that were operating under the chief's orders? What happened to them?
So they ended up getting 1 year prison terms, and then another one ended up getting 2 years and 3 months in prison. So Matiziano certainly got the most of it. The Biscayne Park now, of course, has completely different administration, different officers. So their contention is, you know, we're trying to move past this and we've reformed the department, and we are now, trying to rehab our image.
And let's talk about real briefly this new police chief, Luis Cabrera. What do we know about him and his credentials?
Well, Luis, he's really well known in the law enforcement community here. He was former City of Miami, served some time in the upper echelons of the administration at City Hall and in the City of Miami Police Department. So he's pretty well known, and he goes into that position, with a decent background. So you know, the city now is completely different than it was back in 2013, 2014. So I think, as of right now, they're content with the way the police department administration is going.
And I apologize. Thank you for correcting me on the pronunciation. It's Luis Cabrera. You've been covering, you know, crime. You guys, all of you working on this series, have been covering crime in South Florida for a while. I mean, in the course of reporting the details of this story, and again, the actions taken by this chief in this department at the time, have you ever seen anything like this?
No, and not quite like this, where it's a systematic thing that is, you know, basically orders from the top. And it's a really galling case because it's one of those things that people always assume happens or think happens with police departments, you know, that they just get orders to pin things on people. And, you know, generally that's not always the case. But in this case, it certainly was just so blatant and just so outrageous. And it really, I haven't seen it. And the thing is, with these smaller departments, they fly under the radar often, right? So, you know, in these bigger departments, you're not going to get the level of systematic, you know, framing of people, partly because there's more scrutiny and because they're bigger departments, they're more professional, there's more, you know, eyes on them. But in these small departments, sometimes you get these things that happen and it completely flies under the radar until sometimes years later, just like what happened in this case.
And by the way, David, did you hear from any of the residents in Biscayne Park after the story came in, after everything?
You know, I didn't deal particularly with the residents, but I have to imagine this was just a huge black eye for the village. I mean, it's a small village that's pretty well regarded. It's, considered safe. It's considered, it's one of the things that, they have they used to have like an old log cabin that was historic. That was the police station there. And it's one of those places where you drive through it and it's like, they got the sign. It's like, don't even think about speeding, so they take sort of safety for their residents very, very seriously. So this was an absolute, embarrassment for the village. And it's always going to be there whenever anyone Googles Village of Biscayne Park.
Again, an incredible story. Former Biscayne Park police chief sentenced to 3 years in prison again for instructing his officers to frame and arrest black men for crimes they did not commit. We've been talking with Miami Herald reporter David Ovalle from the studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. David, always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
All right. Just a reminder that we are now in our December Sundial Book Club Challenge, and we want to know from you what's your favorite holiday book of all time. Find our Facebook group and ask to join. Next week, we're going to be talking with Mitchell Kaplan of Books and Books. Well, still to come, is Art Basel out of touch with ordinary art lovers and buyers? Well, there are some people who are trying to change that. We'll tell you all about it coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Art Basel, Miami Art Week can be intimidating for visitors when you consider all the events and all the galleries and everything you can do. It's especially intimidating for artists and collectors because if you don't have a name recognition or a big bank account, getting in as an artist or a buyer is going to be fraught with a lot of barriers. And it can be especially hard for women, minorities, and members of the LGBTQ community. And that's why the show Superfine has a growing fan base during Miami Art Week. It was started by LGBTQ couple artist Alex Mito and James Melli. They went to make events like Miami Art Week accessible to everybody. And again, the collector, the buyer, as well as the artist. Now, this fair prides itself in bringing diversity to Miami's art market with its collective of female artists, artists of color, different sexual orientation, with over 45 booths of independent solo artists and galleries, and it's also affordable. So let me bring in Alex and James. Guys, it's such a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Real quickly, I wanted to get a sense of how you created Superfine, the Superfine Fair. But I wanted to know more a little bit about you guys and how you feel about Art Basel and Miami Art Week. I mean, we've been talking about it all week, but I mean, what's your take? What's your take on the festivities and what does it mean to the city?
Well, I think that events like Art Basel and the entire Art Basel Week, Miami Art Week, are incredible for any city and they bring cultural awareness. And I think that, at this moment, there tends to be a lot of pushback towards the art fair as an establishment, which is arguably the main driver of Art Basel Week. I mean, Art Basel is a huge art fair, and then you have 25 of us that kind of congregate around them. And I think that at its core, an art fair is a really, really wonderful thing. It's a place to discover art. It's a place to buy art. And it's a place for artists and galleries to meet their public and meet their audience. I think that what Art Basel and Miami Art Week have kind of become, and I've kind of borne witness to that. I came to Miami in 2006, lived here for 5 years, and then was in New York for several years back and forth, though. I came to every Basel for 12 years straight. And what I think the challenge of it has been is that it's a bit dichotomous. Like, you have, the sort of parties and events and art parties, which basically are for people who are, treating it like another music festival or a place to, just to drink and have fun, but it's not really about the art. And then you have, on the other side of that, you have the really, really high-end fairs that are just exclusive and no one feels like they can actually collect or buy anything. And that's kind of where we come in.
And that's one of the takes too. And James, your take real quickly is, is it, because I asked the question, is it out of touch with everyday folks? Is it just for the elite? By the way, when I say that, people who can afford lots and lots of, they can spend a lot of money on art.
Exactly. I definitely think that it's out of touch. I think that as anything grows in popularity, but specifically this week, as it grows in popularity, you kind of get further and further away from what the actual point of it is. And all of these fairs, they cost a massive amount to put on, and it costs a massive amount to be a part of them. So the ultimate aim is for there to be an art market, for people to be buying and selling artwork. And the more popular it becomes, the more it just kind of becomes, as Alex said, about just being an art party. Or on the flip side of that, you have people purchasing extremely expensive pieces at the Art Basel main fair. But that in-between is kind of missing, and we feel that that in-between is the most important part. So that's where we come in.
That's what Superfine is, and it's Superfine Fair is there to be create the accessibility for the buyer, but also for the artist, right? Because I mentioned that at the beginning. I'm like, if you're a big-name artist, that's one thing, but if you're not, then it might be a little bit harder to get in. Is that the case, Alex? Tell me what Superfine is for.
Oh, absolutely. So Superfine is the connector between the artists and these potential collectors we just talked about. But as we talk about artists and galleries, one thing you'll find at a lot of fairs is they exclude solo artists. They work only with galleries, or they're only solo artists and they exclude galleries. We've always been a dual model where we have both in our fair, and it improves the overall quality of the fair. If you're an emerging artist and you're trying to get into the art scene and you're trying to get into especially Miami Art Week or Art Basel, there's a lot of bad turns you can take. There's a lot of special projects and little things you can do that really don't get you the value that you deserve out of a week like this. And we're really here for those artists, and especially, as you mentioned, diverse artists, women, artists of color, LGBTQ plus artists, who maybe don't have that easy accessibility to the gallery model or to the traditional art fair model. This is a way that they can hack into the art fair and actually reach, not only reach an art market, but reach what we consider to be a new art market that's basically more on the shoulders of everybody, not just a few people.
And James, for anybody who hasn't seen it, how do you describe really how it's different from other art fairs? Kind of take us through what we can expect.
Yeah, so if you're walking into Superfine, one of the main things that you're going to see different is every single work in the fair, it has a price tag on it that actually lists the price. If you go to other fairs...
You don't see that.
You don't see that.
You do not see that. You see price upon request or, please inquire. You are not seeing the actual price, and we mandate that for everyone. That's something that sometimes we have to train some of our exhibitors, but in the end, they see how valuable it is. It's just a small thing, but it makes a huge difference. You go in, and let's say there's a piece of work that you're interested in, but you don't know how much it costs. Well, for you, you have to step outside of your comfort zone to be able to ask the gallerist or the artist, how much is this? And if it's outside of your price range, then, you feel a little awkward. No one wants to go through that.
Right.
So usually at that point, then people just won't even ask, and then they're losing the chance at purchasing something that they are really interested in.
I live by if the price isn't there, it's probably not for me to ask because I probably can't afford it. But, the other thing too, though, is how do you guys pick the artists? What's the process?
It's a good question. So it's a lot of research that goes into it. And we're always consider ourselves an artist forward fair. So while we also work with galleries, we're always considering actually the artists that are coming to the table. And so it's a lot of research on our team, on our part, on our team's part. Each fair takes between 9 and 12 months to produce, and a lot of that is the research and the kind of outreach to the artists and the galleries. And we choose, again, the diversity we just talked about is really important to us, but I do find that diversity is more of an organic outgrowth of the fact that we're transparent not only to collectors, but how we deal with artists and galleries. We're very fair in our pricing. We're very transparent and straightforward in our pricing. So it's... We see people who, again, might not have access to the market who understand our approach and come on board with us. So, and I've also said that professionalism is huge. I mean, whether it's an artist or a gallery, someone we're able to work with and we're able to maximize their experience is a really important thing.
And the other thing, too, real quickly, is, because you want to get more women, more minorities, more mm-hmm. LGBTQ artists out there. I wanted to get the sense, I mean, in the art world, especially down here in Miami, is it tough for women, minorities, and LGBTQ artists to get noticed?
I think it's tough in almost every market, and it's something that I think that people outside of the quote-unquote art world don't really realize about the art world. They think it's all free and everything, and honestly, there's a lot of difficulty because the galleries are predominantly run by white men, and the fairs are too. So if you're an artist of color or a women artist, it can be difficult to get through that, to break through that ceiling. And so I do think it's very difficult. And when representation is the main goal by a gallery, that can often be a lost dream. And we're able to offer an opportunity to be in a professional setting that's very, very much market focused and without necessarily having to wait around for the representation.
I'm talking with the co-founders of the Superfine Fair, Alex Mito and James Melly, about how they've been bringing diversity to the art scene of Miami for the past 4 years. Their satellite fair is focused on artists of color, different sexual orientation, and female artists as well. And as you've heard also about price, it's about price and making sure that it's accessible accessible to a lot of people. Tell us about this year's fair. What are some of the highlights, James? What can people expect? What are a couple of artists that you are really excited about?
Yeah, so one that I'm really excited about, and you just mentioned about the diversity that we care a lot about, there's Art Gazel. It's actually another art fair that takes place in South Beach. It's labeled the gayest fair in Miami. So they actually have a satellite booth at our fair. And so it's like an Art Gazel satellite. And there's some really incredible artists in that booth. There's Jonathan Ken Adams, there's Courtney Charles, and there's Julius Bautista. There's also a few others. They're really fantastic, just kind of gives you a very contemporary look at LGBT art today. And then, Alex, do you want to mention some other ones?
Yeah, no, we have some fantastic artists, and one that I'm really keen on is actually a duo, Strasberg Mandel, and they do kind of like this pop icon surrealism. So they're pulling people like Michael Jackson and Liza Minnelli in doing these really like kind of, I don't know, like very bright, vibrant, textural, mixed media paintings. And they're very, very cool. I'm really excited for them. And also Art Gazel, as James mentioned.
How is, because you guys have been at this now for a few years, and I'm wondering how much Art Basel, but mostly Art Miami Art Week, has changed. You know, I wanted to get your take. Is it getting better? Is it growing? Is it bringing more diversity? And really, is it helping Miami's position, I guess, in the art world worldwide? But Alex, what your take over what you've seen over the last few years?
Yeah, of course. I think that Art Basel or Miami Art Week is starting to become more of a platform for some urgent social issues. One that we're really focusing on is climate change. We have a panel on climate change. We actually have the Miami Beach director of environment, who will be speaking on that panel. And I think that's an urgent one. The LGBT conversation, I think, is becoming more apparent in Miami. I think that it's a platform that's evolving, and it definitely helps the city. I think it brings a lot of issues to a table that everyone can see them and talk about them.
And you know, James, the other thing too is for people who've never been, you know, maybe they just look at it as like, oh, it's, you know, it's for the rich and a lot of fancy stuff that I'm not, how do you convince somebody? No, you got to come check it out because there's a lot more going on than you think.
Yeah. So one other thing besides the art itself that we do in the fair is we have these kind of peripheral cultural events that happen. So there's actually a film series during the fair. What do you call it?
Curated.
It's a curated. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Alex. Curated by Outshine Film Festival. And then there's also we have a Young Collectors Ice Cream Social that's on Friday evening. And so we kind of bring in other things to kind of illustrate to people that, yes, this is for you. We're creating a fair, an environment, an art purchasing environment that is designed for you. And it really does feel that way. I mean, we have people come into the fair and they come up to us and they say, I've never considered that I could buy art. And now I have.
And that is what Superfine Fair is all about. And again, if you don't go to the main fair, I guess, of Art Basel, there's so many other things to see, as we've been trying to point out all week. Superfine Fair is one of them. Talking to co-founders Alex Mito and James Melly, again, about Superfine and what to expect and some of the artists. Again, a rich diversity. And we're going to have, by the way, we're going to have a Facebook Live from the fair later today, I believe it is. So that way you can get more of a sense, too, as well. So if you think you can't afford the art, maybe you can. Alex, James, it's such a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a great Art Basel Miami Art Week for 2018. Well, still to come, we're going to take you to the Gold Dust Motel for a unique series of short plays. It's coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. So you've probably been to a theatrical performance, right? You went to a theater, you got into your seat, and then there was the stage. It was at a distance, and the actors were on the stage, and of course, there's always the fourth wall. Imagine you're watching a play in a motel room. There are only two actors and only four members of the audience, and the actors are moving around you, and they're even interacting with you. Well, that's what you can expect from Miami Motel Stories being performed at the Gold Dust Motel. It's a series of stories told in different rooms. By the way, you can check out a video on our Instagram page at WLRN. And we're joined now by Juan Sanchez, the playwright behind Miami Motel Stories, that was also put on by, I should mention, Juggernaut Theater Company. Juan, such a pleasure, man.
Ah, thank you for having me.
This was a lot of fun. I went Friday, and so just to point out how it works out, I mean, you get a key, a room key, and they're in three different colors, blue, pink, and yellow. Mm-hmm. And when you get your key, you're going to see three plays in those doors, the yellow doors, red or pink doors, blue doors. Mm-hmm. Where did the idea for Miami Motel Stories even come from?
Well, it started like in 2011, actually. I had written, I've always been fascinated by motels and the histories behind them. And I'd written a traditional theater for a stage about this motel on Calle Ocho. And at around this point, Tanya Bravo and I reconnected. She read the play and wanted to do something with it. She had been working in an immersive piece in New York City at the time and sort of came back to me and said, how would you, feel about doing something like this in an actual building, telling the history of that particular motel or building and neighborhood at the same time? And so from there, the idea of Miami Motel Stories was created, and we're in our second, version right now.
This is fascinating because you think about, you're at this, at the Gold Dust Hotel, and this has already been bought and they're going to renovate it. And this is something we've seen on Biscayne Boulevard, is some of these old motels, from the 60s, these Art Deco motels are being rejuvenated, and life is coming back to that community in a very different way. You used to live out in that community.
Yeah, I lived on 64th in Biscayne in the 90s. So I remember.
For people who weren't here, tell us about what the community was like.
It was very shady. It was, I spent some time. Out in the streets, and it was dilapidated. It was really cheap. And it was a little scary, honestly,
And so what do you think about everything that you've seen and how that part of the community is changing?
It is so pristine. I hadn't been there in several years, until we knew that we were going into this particular neighborhood in this hotel. And I was literally blown away, by all the changes, by the way that by the upkeep of the neighborhood, by just how different it was. It just looked and felt like a different world than when I lived there.
So is the collection of stories that are being performed in this, in the hotel, is it about trying to tell the history of not just the hotel, but this community?
Yeah, yes, it's both. I mean, what we try to do is tell the history of the people who either stayed or lived in or worked in this hotel, but also these stories are represent the boulevard at a given time. That's why all of the pieces are set in different decades or, different years. And it's our way of, painting a picture of this is how it used to be without it being a history lesson.
Yeah, so and you did a lot. You had to do a lot of research for this.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the library going through, Miami Herald articles. We do a lot of work with the Miami History Museum. Dr. Paul George has been incredible with the information he's given us, interviewing people from the communities, and then piecing it all together.
All right, so let's talk about how these stories are set up. And again, just to paint this picture. So, you're going to walk into a room with three other people, and there isn't always a place to sit. And mm-hmm. by the way, can I just say, I'm the guy who was standing every time, and which is fine, but it was also awkward because now the performers are performing, and there's no fourth wall. There's no wall. They're performing. You're part of it. And I found myself moving around, trying not to get in the way, which I think added to the tension, which was interesting. Yeah. Where did you, I mean, tell us about, you know, like some of the inspirations you found, because as you said, some of the stories, they all take place in different eras, different decades.
Yes, yes. Well, I think the particular tracks that you went to was the yellow track.
Yes.
And one of those rooms was set in 1976. It was between a prostitute and her John. And that piece was actually inspired by an interview with that I found from 1976 with the owner of the motel at the time, who was interviewed about the decline that had sort of begun in the neighborhood. And to me, that was surprising that, you know, in the 70s, that area was already hitting its downward slope.
Yeah.
So I wanted to explore that and say, well, this is how it happened, and this is why. And that's why the conversation happens about, you know, the malls taking people away from the businesses. The highway, you know, was a big contributor to people not taking Biscayne Boulevard anymore. So all of these motels started to not be used anymore. Airplanes became a huge way of traveling. So tourism, you know, the golden age of the car and the road trip was already out the window. People were flying to the Bahamas now because it was so much easier and less expensive than it had been in the 50s. Anyway, that's one story.
Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things, too, is that, okay, so these are short plays, by the way.
I mean, yeah.
10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And again, it's one or two actors only. And I remember one of them is a couple, and I don't know what era they were in, but it was
the 1959 Golden Age couple.
Okay.
Is what we call them.
I thought what was fascinating about this is that, you know, a lot of time is passing in this 15-minute block. I mean, you see them, they arrive, they're happy, and then all of a sudden you see the downward spiral of the husband falling into gambling and then into crime and so forth. But as a playwright, what's the challenge of trying to write a play that's going to fit in a small time slot and in a tight space?
Yeah, it's you know, short plays are probably the hardest pieces of, you know, playwriting to do. You know, as long as you have a premise, and I really wanted to work with this idea of this couple who was coming to Miami for the first time, and they needed to get somewhere, like their journey, their psychological and emotional journey and physical journey had to end, you know, in some other place. The short vignettes that happened sort of take us into the dissolution of the marriage because they discover, you know, that there is this gambling and there is all of this corruption, you know, that is sort of attractive. And so all of that became, you know, a way of telling the story.
And it was just, again, within that 15-minute period that, you know, it's almost like there's no, in a regular play, you know, in act one, act two, act three break apart. In this one, there's got to be a quick transition because there really are still three acts in this small little time frame. Again, I'm talking with Juan Sanchez of Juggernaut Theater Company. They're behind the Miami Motel Stories. It's happening at the Gold Dust Theater in Miami. By the way, you can see videos and photos of the stories on WLRN's Instagram at WLRN. The show is running through December 23rd. We did have a clip, by the way, and I wanted to play a little bit of it so you can get a sense of how it feels when you're walking in this room and you're literally just a couple of feet away from the performers.
You touch me with your hands and your fingers and your... Oh, God. Don't look at me!
What are you doing? Come out from under there.
Is this, you know what I was thinking about, because you've seen these as well, there's micro theater here in Miami.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I've seen around the country and in other parts of the world, you know, this, you know, performance is now leaving the big stage and looking for smaller spaces and different kinds of spaces. Is this where we're going?
I think so. I think so. I think that, you know, I think that theater, like immersive site-specific theater, is providing not only a different kind of stage, you know, and a different way of telling stories. It's also creating the art in a more intimate, you know, bridging the intimacy between audience, performer, and crew in general. And I think that, you know, I think that we're all sort of craving that kind of intimacy. You know, I think, you know, we spend so much time on the internet and we don't say these things, but I think inside, you know, we want to be closer to the action.
And I will say, too, the play with the boxer.
Yeah.
You know, that was a very intense one. And I remember I was actually the one he was interacting with. Yeah. I started writing he wanted me to write a letter for him.
Yeah.
And I thought, I've never been in a show where I'm actually not taking dictation.
Yeah.
What's next? What's are you working on the next one for next year? Where is it going to be, if you could tell us?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We are working on, we're going into two different neighborhoods. Next, we're going to North Beach. So we're hitting, you know, that beautiful little area up there. And then we'll be going into Overtown. So we've got our work cut out. And, you know, we're just now starting the research process.
It is a fun and fascinating series. Again, Miami Motel Stories. It's happening right now at the Gold Dust Theater in Miami. And it runs through December 23rd. Again, a really different experience when you're talking about theater. So if you haven't had it, I mean, it depends. If you want to get intimate with the actors, you're going to be in there. You're going to be part of the show in one way or another. Juan Sanchez, again, the playwright for the Miami Motel Stories. Juan, such a pleasure, man.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And they are a lot of fun, no question about it. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, December 5th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We're going to talk to you again tomorrow.